Just days before the second anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, U.S. President Joe Biden called Vladimir Putin a crazy SOB. According to media reports, Biden said this to a small group of donors at a fundraising event in San Francisco. But it wasn't long before his words reached Kremlin officials in Moscow. Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said it was a shameful thing for the U.S. president to say and accused Biden of acting like a Hollywood cowboy. But Putin seemed to take it in stride, telling a state television reporter, quote, "We are ready to work with any president, but I believe that for us, for Russia, Biden is a more preferable president. And judging by what he has just said, I am absolutely right." This was the second time Putin had told state television that it would be better to have Biden in the White House than his rival, Donald Trump. In an earlier interview, the Russian president said that he'd prefer to deal with Biden because he's, quote, "a more experienced person, he's predictable, and he's an old-school politician." With a U.S. presidential election on the horizon, it's entirely possible that Putin will be dealing with a very different American administration this time next year. And with Biden staking his reputation and perhaps even his presidency on his administration's foreign policy, it's worth taking a look back at their last 3 years in office. Welcome to the Naked Pravda. Hello, you're listening to the Naked Pravda, Medusa's English language podcast. I'm Eilish Hart, your host for this episode and the editor of The Beat, Medusa's weekly long reads newsletter covering Central and Eastern Europe, the Caucasus, and Central Asia. For this week's show, I'm joined by Alex Ward, a national security reporter at Politico and the author of a brand new book titled The Internationalists: The Fight to Restore American Foreign Policy After Trump. Alex's book offers the inside scoop on what Team Biden learned from Donald Trump's foreign policy, their original plan for handling relations with Vladimir Putin's Russia and Volodymyr Zelensky's Ukraine, and their Hail Mary attempts to prevent Moscow's full-scale invasion in 2022. We discuss all of that and more in the interview, so let's get into it. Judging a book by its cover, you might assume that Joe Biden is the main character in your story, but your book really begins and ends with Biden's national security advisor, Jake Sullivan. So I wanted to ask you, why is he so central to American foreign policy after Trump?
I think he's the most powerful national security advisor since McGeorge Bundy, who was John F. Kennedy Jr.'s national security advisor, both the youngest to do it. The reason being twofold. One, Jake spent, and he likes to go by Jake, by the way. It's very important to him that people call him Jake. So Jake, he was working for Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016. He was crushed, as were a lot of members of her team, to lose to Donald Trump. And he believed that one reason, not the reason, but one reason why she lost was because of Trump's foreign policy message, which effectively was, we're doing too much abroad. America keeps losing. We need to focus more on the home front. So Jake spends the next 4 years of Trump's presidency trying to figure out how to marry his very traditionalist, Clinton-esque, Democratic, uppercase D foreign policy with this Trumpian ideology. And he comes up with colleagues, this idea of a foreign policy for the middle class, which in short means whatever America does in the world has to first and foremost help the American middle class. So that idea fits very nicely with like Biden's whole MO. And they work together in the Obama administration and beyond. And so he's brought his national security advisor. And that leads to sort of point number two, which is Biden, for all of his experience on foreign policy, is a delegator. And he really has let Jake take full reins of, you know, the American foreign policy machine. To be clear, the national security advisor position is supposed to do that. You're supposed to be sort of the head interagency coordinator. But I would venture to say that Biden gives, you know, Sullivan his four corners, or let's call it like a sandbox, and Sullivan gets to play in it. And they kind of have a mind meld of this, of how to operate in the world. And so what you're seeing really is Jake Sullivan's thinking about foreign policy filtered through Joe Biden's experience. So it's obviously they're not doing anything that Biden wouldn't want, right? He is still the president, but Biden basically says what he wants and Jake tries to make it happen, of course, in coordination with the president. But he is effectively making foreign policy, and he has brought that sort of trauma of losing to Trump, bringing in some Trumpian ideas into a Biden foreign policy sort of central. And so that's why I think in some weird way, like if Biden is sunsetting his career, Jake's in some way is sort of sunrising, even though he's been in the game a long time. And so I think you're going to see sort of Bidenism, let's say, exist for a while through Jake.
When you've got this new administration stepping in post-Trump, how central is Russia and relations with Moscow to their thinking on foreign policy? And the obvious second part of that is, how does Ukraine factor in?
So I think a couple of things. The administration came in with the same sort of Trumpian notion of great power competition is the be-all end-all. And the main focus was China, like, to be clear. And it still is to this moment, despite all the stuff happening in the world. So the U.S.-China relationship is still, first and foremost, what they care about. Russia, the administration felt they could kind of park in the sense that, yes, there was the whole solar wind situation and, of course, Ukraine. And there was that moment at the beginning of 2021. Where the Russians put troops outside of Ukraine, which led inevitably to the Geneva summit in the summer of 2021. And after that meeting, you know, where Biden and Putin talk, Biden's team kind of starts high-fiving and going, okay, it's not like Russia is solved. It's not like the problems are gone, but we're at a point of understanding that it's not going to be a problem. And we can start focusing, I'm talking as if I were the administration, we can start focusing on China and climate change and all other big issues. And I don't have to trust Putin, but like, he gets where we're coming. So this is just not going to be a major concern. Obviously, that turned out not to be true. And I think Ukraine at the beginning was on the back burner, right? I mean, it's not like Biden or Jake or any or Secretary of State Antony Blinken or anyone else didn't care about Ukraine or the war that was ongoing, but it wasn't urgent. Right. There were a lot of conflicts happening in the world that weren't urgent. But of course, in the run up to the invasion itself brought it right to the top of the pile.
Many of members of the Biden administration, including Biden himself and Jake Sullivan and Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who you just mentioned, they were also part of the Obama administration. They pursued a reset with Russia from 2009 to 2013 and then had to respond to Russia's first invasion of Ukraine and the annexation of Crimea. So is putting Russia on the back burner, as they, you know, initially tried to do, is this a break with the Obama administration's foreign policy, or were they trying to sort of carry that same approach through?
I will answer your question, but sort of in the macro sense, one of the more interesting things about this is, as many Obama era players as there are, they really try hard to not do Obama's foreign policy. They'll say it all the time. Times have changed. It's post-Trump after all. There's just a new political and global context. They'll stand by their foreign policy of the Obama years, but they say that that was appropriate for that time. This is a new era, ergo, we need a new foreign policy, right? I mean, there was still significant U.S.-China competition in the Obama years, but they felt that this was now like the be-all end-all, ergo, it had to be the highest level thing. So coming back to your main question, yes, it was a break from the Obama era reset. I think they felt after Crimea, and especially getting burned, I should say, these Obama folks, right? Because they felt that they didn't do enough to push back on Russia. That's still sort of a thing that they hold, that Russia was untrustworthy and could not really be dealt with in the sense of getting closer to it, but that it was an actor that when there were moments of cooperation, it could happen, but in moments of confrontation, they could do that. Similar outlook to China, by the way. So no, this was not a sense of like, let's trust Russia or get closer to it. It was more, it's an actor like all of us who will make deals that are in its national interest and that will only pursue the national interest. I think that despite the U.S. having tons of intelligence, of course, and being proven right about what Russia wanted to do in Ukraine, there was still a sense of like, Russia's not crazy enough to do this, right? Or they're not going to be crazy enough to do anything like this. That's just not who they are. So I think if you talk to Biden's team, they'll feel sort of vindicated in that they didn't pursue an Obama era or even a Trump era style Russia policy. They'll say that they sort of erred in thinking that they could park the issue, but they didn't err in sort of their outlook on Moscow.
One thing you come back to over and over again in the book is that Biden sort of likes this personal touch to international relations. He likes to sit down one-on-one with leaders and look them in the eye. He already had a relationship, so to speak, with Putin since Putin's in power for so long. But how does having Zelensky in power in Kyiv as this absolute newcomer to politics, what role does this play?
Such a good question. And something I struggled to sort of tease out in the book. You're right. I bring it up a lot because I think that is like the key to how Biden sees the world. He and Trump actually have a very similar worldview, which is just get me in a room. I'll talk to the guy and I'll get a sense of their four corners, right? So Zelensky being new, like Biden still felt confident in his ability to do diplomacy. But I think that the fact that he sort of brushed Zelensky off for a little bit, right? He's a neophyte. Ukraine is not at the top of my agenda. It's more important for us to sort of clear the air with Russia and tell them the extent of how this relationship is going to go going forward. That was more of a priority than like being friends with Zelensky. And so they, Biden pushes the Zelensky meeting until pretty late. They talk a little bit before the Geneva summit and then they meet later on. The interesting thing here is I think they weren't able to really build a rapport because when they really started engaging, a war was about to happen. And on top of that, Zelensky was adamant that this invasion was non-existent. And so their calls got pretty intense. And I know we understand now that the US and Ukraine were at odds during that time period, but I don't think it's understood as much. And I try to tease out in the book just how angry the Ukrainians were with the US, feeling they had been brushed off. And then after being brushed off, being told how wrong they were about Russia when the Ukrainians felt that they know Russia better than anyone else. And as much as the US thought, man, is Putin this crazy? The Ukrainians thought it was ludicrous that this thing would happen. So to have Biden, who they really didn't like, and Zelensky really didn't like for much of 2021, to kind of lecture him and say that you don't know what you're doing, really pissed him off. And really, I think it would have had a really bad relationship had it not been for the invasion, which the US becomes the key partner, and I still don't think they necessarily like each other that much. I think they understand each other, which is like central to Biden's foreign policy anyway. He doesn't have to like the guy, just understand where he's coming. And I think both men now understand where they're at. Although, of course, there's tons of tensions where, of course, naturally the Ukrainians want tons of stuff to be sent and the U.S. isn't going to send it all.
We're going to circle back to that. But I think just to kind of keep us in 2021, as Russia's military buildup is happening on Ukraine's borders, the Biden administration first has to contend with the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan and the fall of Kabul. How did the experience of leaving Afghanistan influence their handling of the buildup to Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine?
In a couple of ways. One was you need to be a bit more upfront about the intelligence you have. They felt that the fall of Kabul would take about 18 to 24 months. That's what the intelligence signaled. Obviously, that timeline shrunk as the Taliban was advancing, but at the time of decision to withdraw, they thought they had about 2 years before the country collapsed. They didn't put out their thinking when they made the decision. They didn't put out anything else. They didn't really give their thought process behind it all, other than everyone sort of knew Biden wanted out. And so Jake and his team learned from Afghanistan, we need to be way more upfront about communications. We need to be way more upfront about maybe declassifying intelligence. And then we need to be really damn sure about what we know and what we don't know. And so they spent a lot of time, I think, in the aftermath of Afghanistan, figuring out their processes, how to really get their minds around how a government's going to handle something so large. And I think they were just also looking for some moment of redemption, right? As much as you talk to the administration, it'll say on the strategic level, sure, it was the right decision, right? And like, you can argue yes or no, but on an emotional level, on like a personal level, or all a professional level, these people need jobs still in the future. They all felt hurt and they wanted not necessarily this, but I think they were all looking in some way for a moment of, we are a great team, we can figure this out, and we can do right by the United States and the world. And of course, the intelligence of Russia's intended invasion of Ukraine came pretty soon after the fall of Kabul. And so they didn't really have a moment to lick their wounds. They just kind of went into it, but immediately started putting in some of the learned lessons from that into practice.
Your book really underscores the extent to which U.S. intelligence indicated that Putin really was planning to invade Ukraine, and that the experience that U.S. officials had when they were going through the diplomacy before the actual invasion gave them the impression that he really couldn't be talked down. Since we know now that this was in fact the case, why was Washington so intent on pursuing diplomacy, and why not take another approach like arming Ukraine, for example?
There was a sense that the U.S. wanted to be caught trying, right? I guess they felt this way. If the U.S. just started arming Ukraine right away, then Putin almost had to respond, almost had to invade, right? I mean, the notion that somehow that was going to deter Putin, they felt was folly. They were willing, truly willing to have the conversation with Putin, like, all right, so you think NATO's bad? You think there's been too much expansion? You think we're too close to Ukraine? Like, let's talk this out. You wouldn't have found anyone in the Biden administration who really believed that Putin was going to change his mind for having that diplomacy. But it was better almost for their own narrative to be caught trying. Look, we tried to talk to the guy. We tried to solve this peacefully. he started the war. He decided to cut off diplomacy. And so now we can arm Ukraine. Now the world can rally behind. And you talk to the Biden administration, they would say that it was part of the reason the West rallied around is because of the diplomatic channel. They did try to stop the war through diplomatic means. They created a whole declassification of intelligence program to stop the war. Like, they really went above and beyond. Putin went through with it anyway. And so they went, all right, now, not only we, but now the world sees this was Putin's unilateral decision. Let's defend Ukraine. But of course, if you're a Ukrainian or the Ukrainian government, that doesn't satisfy, right? Of course, you wanted the weapons of war. And there are a lot of people in the U.S. who still feel it was a mistake to not send weapons right away. But the Biden administration really did believe that they needed to do the diplomatic part for the legitimacy of their cause.
After Russia actually invaded, it became clear really quickly that U.S. intelligence was very accurate in terms of what Moscow's invasion plan was, but it overestimated the strength and the professionalism of the Russian army. Do you have an idea of why that was the case?
A couple of reasons, but I think the main one is somewhat the same thing that happened in Afghanistan, which is it's really good to know the kinds of weapons, the number of soldiers, the plans. It's hard to know the will of the soldier. And I think what we've been finding is that for many reasons, the Russian troops don't have their hearts in it. I mean, a lot of them do, but a significant number don't, including the ones that have been mobilized, some conscripts. And recall that they were just hanging out on the border of Ukraine for months without the right provisions. I mean, morale was low. And so I think part of it was, why couldn't Russia take over? They should be able to. They just have the better military. Meanwhile, U.S. intelligence, I think, underestimated the will of the Ukrainian people to defend themselves. So that is a gap in American intelligence gathering. And intelligence gathering in general, but one that I know this administration is trying to address. How can you start to get a sense of like a willingness to fight for your people, for your government, for your country, that they didn't really have? The other bit of this is that Russia just had old systems and it's sort of been inflating what it did. And I think that there was a general perception of like, because Russia's building hypersonic missiles and these maneuverable whatever, that therefore it's a high-tech military. And like, there's just a big gray zone in between that, right? So there was just a miscalculation there. Finally, it should be noted, the administration had, and this then Joint Chiefs Chair Mark Milley, the general, who was like, look, there are five scenarios of how this could all go down. The fifth one, and not the one that he said was necessarily the most likely, was that Kyiv would be taken in 72 hours. But it was in the scenario, right? Like, it was a possibility. So it's not like it was out of the question in American intelligence thinking. It was part of the possibilities. It wasn't necessarily the highest one, but that it shows where the American thinking was on this whole thing.
In terms of the scenario for Ukraine, it seemed as though U.S. officials and military officials were pretty sure that Kyiv was going to fall pretty fast. So it seems like you're saying that U.S. intelligence and military analysis underestimated Russia and Ukraine for the same reason? Or am I misinterpreting you there?
No, I think that's possible. And again, the same thing with the Afghan military. They didn't necessarily understand the will, where the Afghans didn't necessarily want to fight for their government. The Ukrainians wanted to fight for their country. While many Russian troops believe in the cause, a lot don't. And then there's, of course, training and tactics and a whole bunch of things we don't need to go fully into. But like, of course, there's also the question of why did the Russians use the Air Force at the beginning as much? There's still some unknown stuff here, but there was a general sense of, look how much stronger the Russians are just materially than the Ukrainians. And look at their willingness to basically blitzkrieg across the country. They can do this. I think one bit that sort of fell by the wayside, and I remember asking U.S. officials and experts this at the time, not necessarily for the book, but in my own reporting work, was like the northern part of Ukraine would be like Toronto, and the southern part of Ukraine would be like Raleigh, North Carolina. And of course, that's not even east to west. Like, that's big. So you're trying to invade Ukraine with, I think it was about 200,000 troops at the time that were on the border, 200, 300,000. Yeah, you could occupy territory. Could you hold the country that size with a force, frankly, that small for the whole of the country? Doesn't mean you can't topple Kyiv and kill Zelensky and all that, but to basically say like you will completely conquer Ukraine with that force just didn't seem likely. And so that, I think there was some mixed analysis somewhere where like, yes, Kyiv could fall, but does that mean Ukraine falls? That wasn't always clear.
It sounds as though the Biden administration didn't have a lot of hope in terms of actually talking Russia down. They didn't think diplomacy would succeed. did they still have to come to terms with their inability to prevent a full-scale war? Like, was that still seen as a failure on the U.S.'s part, or was it more like we gave it our best shot? Like, what did it mean for the U.S. that it wasn't able to sort of handle this diplomatically?
Yeah, I wrestled with this question. First of what officials said, they were very clear that, like, we put our best foot forward. We did the diplomatic effort. We informed the Ukrainians. We informed the world and our partners about what was going to happen, and we were right. And even though we did everything right, we still saw the invasion of Ukraine, and, like, that sucks. That's how they'll describe it. But they'll all say, look, Putin was going to do what he was going to do, unless he really cared about this diplomatic effort, which it was clear he didn't. To sort of a grander takeaway, which I tried to do, I mean, if I tried to explain a Biden doctrine, it was like America cannot be the strongest power anymore unless it can influence great powers, or at least compete with them. And in this case, the U.S. showed that it was feckless in stopping Russia from doing what it was doing. It's been very good in rallying the world to Ukraine's cause and standing by Ukraine, I mean, until recently, but unable to convince Putin. So there's a bit of, like, you know, maybe America's influence really is more limited than it used to be. America's word isn't as feared as it used to be, even if all the things were done right. Because that's the thing, is like, I would argue that the Biden administration did about as much right as they could throughout this whole process. But even then, with basically an A-plus score, you still failed the test. Now, there'll be people out there listening and fairly going, well, they, as we talked about earlier, you didn't send weapons ahead of time. You could have sanctioned Russia, killed Nord Stream 2 much earlier. Like, all that stuff, that's all well and good. But I think anyone you talk to, Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, would say, overall, the Biden administration handled the run-up to the invasion exceedingly well, and still look what happened. So there's a bit of resignation about the whole thing.
And so what about the response to the invasion itself? Your book charts sort of the first year of the war. What's their report card for that time period? How does the Biden doctrine play out, not just in terms of, like, this preventative diplomacy, but once there's actually a hot war going on?
The book ends in February 2023. I was there for Biden's speech in Poland, and it felt like almost a political rally for NATO. Like, his music was blaring. It was like Twisted Sister, right? Ukrainian, American, Polish flags. Like, it felt kind of like a mission accomplished moment, just without the banner. And at that moment, I can tell you, because I was there, like, the feeling of optimism was palpable. We're a year later from that speech, and, you know, had I been finishing the book now, there would be a completely different sentiment. It's not to say that the U.S. has given up on Ukraine, but, like, it's clearly less interested, not necessarily the Biden administration, but the whole U.S. political apparatus. Because of that, there's questions about commitment from other Western countries. And while there's not necessarily a stalemate, right, I understand that Ukrainian troops are pushing Russian forces out in the Black Sea. On the ground, it's basically a game of ping pong. So it's very different from that sort of moment where, you know, it's before the counteroffensive and all that, right? There was a real moment of optimism that has totally declined. And granted, of course, now we've got Israel versus Hamas. It's still top of mind, but it's still kind of on the back burner at the same time. So it's to this report card. I mean, I think up till February 2023, it was about as good as it could be. The grade is worse now. I don't know how to grade it yet, because I think we're still in this weird moment, but it's definitely not as good. I know it's bothering Team Biden that they effectively had a mission accomplished moment and feeling, and it's nowhere near that.
To zoom out from Russia and Ukraine, is there something that you can point to as sort of a through line in the Biden administration's foreign policy during its first 2 years? What did the first 2 years tell us?
The first 2 years told us that Biden does not want to get distracted by what he considers to be side issues of global order, that he cares deeply and will focus all of his time and attention on principles and foreign issues that he feel are, of course, about protecting America, the West, but also the democratic small d world order. So when it comes to Ukraine, Russia, that's obvious. A major power trying to wipe another country off the map. In the case of Israel, Hamas, for example, and I noted in the book, the initial Israel-Hamas fight of the Biden administration, Biden cares very deeply about Israel. He thinks its existence is part and parcel of a democratic world order, right? Hamas has stated it wants to wipe Israel off the map. So to protect Israel, to help it defend itself, is also part of that. To be able to compete with China, the prime example, to keep Russia on a back burner, but still deal with it, and whether it's election interference, cybersecurity, Ukraine, that's all part of it. climate change is part of it. And all of these side skirmishes, I mean, I'm speaking from their point of view, not to say that what's happening in Sudan is unimportant, not to say that what's happening in DRC is unimportant, not to say that North Korea is solved, but like all of those are peripheral. The through line is basically the foreign policy version of Twitter is not real life. Just keep focused on the things that actually matter and that people are focused on and care about. And all those side conversations, we'll deal with them, but they should not be at the center of what we do.
And so to follow up on that, why do you refer to Biden and his team as internationalists? This is the title of your book. Why did you pick that term?
It was contrasting with Team Trump, right? I mean, Trump called people globalists derogatorily, and in a book titled The Globalists for Biden would have come off wrong. But the internationalists, I mean, I think does, you know, encompass who they were. Like, they believe in an international America, but they also believe that for America to do what it needs to do at home and to be strongest at home, it needs to have sort of international outlook and the help of allies in part. They reject this notion that America can restrain itself, cannot care about the world in a way like a Donald Trump or a Vivek Ramaswamy or other, or even a Ron DeSantis to some extent. They reject that notion, and they firmly believe that an America without partners, without friends, that's not active in the world, makes not only the world less safe, but also Americans less safe. And they, and in a weird way, the best homeland defense, the best way to care about the middle class, the best way to care about the American is to engage the world. But you still can engage the world skeptically. And in some ways they do, right? The tariffs remain on China. They've passed the Inflation Reduction Act to provide subsidies on climate-related issues. It doesn't necessarily have to be like free trade, liberal world order classic. They're updating the software of the liberal world order in their mind for the current times, but it is still very international. Despite all their American foreign policy for the middle class rhetoric, it is still a very outward-looking team.
So at one point in the book, you say that in 2021, officials in the Biden administration wanted to make sure they were remembered for something other than Afghanistan. This is before Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, of course. But at the juncture we're at now, what do you think they'll be remembered for?
If Biden were to lose to Trump, presumably, in November, then they'll all be seen as a failure, because if you're only a one-term president, it's usually not seen particularly in a glowing light. Outside of Afghanistan, I think they will be seen as very successful at the initial part on Russia-Ukraine. And I think that every future administration is going to borrow some of their playbook, especially the downgrade of intelligence to make their case. That was a novel decision, and that I think is going to completely change the nuts and bolts of U.S. foreign policy making for quite some time. I think they'll also be remembered for a continuation of a lot of Trump stuff, right? If we zoom out, especially, and I can imagine a historian 50 years from now, we'll say there was kind of a post-George W. Bush moment where Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and Joe Biden, all different outlooks, but ultimately sort of came to, we can't do stupid stuff. We've got to focus on the big things, and we've got to focus on Americans. They all, to some extent, made that argument very differently in different situations. And so one is the novelty. Two is interesting. Three is a trend. And Biden solidifies this. And again, it's the China policy. It's the focus on the, you know, American middle class and the American worker. It's this change up of global economics, which I think is sort of an undercovered part. And frankly, if I were smarter at economics, I would have talked about more in the book. But that, I think, is what it's going to be. And it ultimately, I think, being a full-throated defender of the sort of post-1945 consensus that, frankly, no American president or politician in recent days is kind of willing to bank their entire political career. And they're basically saying, outside of the, you know, small-d democracy issues in the U.S., as, you know, as Trump might come back to the Oval Office, Biden is basically saying democracy at home and abroad matters. And the order that we and our allies and partners set up after World War II matters. And it sort of takes a guy who was 3 years old when World War II ended to make that case, because like he feels it in his bones. Like, it's not necessarily a talking point. In fact, it's not just a talking point. It is a thing he believes, and it animates everything he's doing. And so when we talked earlier about Jake Sullivan doing everything, Jake has to know that he can't come back to Biden and brief any policy issue unless ultimately it can be defended as, how does this protect and renew the world order that we've inherited?
Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been The Naked Pravda, a podcast from Medusa in English. Remember that undesirable status back in Russia means our entire news outlet now relies on readers and listeners around the world to support our work. Please visit our website for information about how to become a contributor with one-time or recurring pledges. Thanks again. Until next week.